Turns out Jacksonville isn't the only city looking to solve its public pension problems. Good Monday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through our WJCT app. And just ahead, a look at some of the other places around the country tackling their own pension mess. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a preview of this week's TEDx talk in Jacksonville about the importance of vaccinations. Plus, don't miss Culpepper. He's got the latest as the Jaguars close in on their search for a new head coach. All of that ahead. But first, this hour, 2017 is kicking off with the city of Jacksonville still at loggerheads with its public safety unions. High-stakes negotiations between local police and firefighter unions and City Hall over retirement packages for future employees, while they ended at the close of 2016 with no final agreement as yet. Those collective bargaining sessions are a key piece of Mayor Lenny Curry's efforts to reform Jacksonville's employee pension system. But Curry's plan to pay down pension debt is being met with stiff resistance from police and fire. They say Curry's push to enroll future hires into a 401k-type plan would strip away their guaranteed retirement benefits and make it hard to attract new talent. So where does all this stand? Well, we're going to start the hour with a look at where things are in Jacksonville and also how other cities are dealing with their pension issues. Bob Klausner is founding partner at Klausner, Kaufman, Jensen, and Levinson. That's a Florida firm specializing in public pension law. He's a national authority on public pensions, and he's on the line now. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And to our callers, what are your questions about how Jacksonville is going to try to resolve its pension standoff between the mayor and the police and fire unions? What do you think about all this? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on our Facebook page. And Bob, as I mentioned, you're a national authority on public pension law and legislation around it. In a moment, we'll talk about Jacksonville's situation. But first, let's draw some parallels because you're monitoring pension fights and negotiations around the country. Let's go over now to Dallas, Texas. Can you describe how Dallas is dealing with its pension situation?
Well, as you know, Dallas has a very serious funding problem in its public safety, police and fire pension. Back in the 1980s, they added some very expensive cost features, and the city did not contribute the cost associated with them, nor did the members. And as the workforce has aged and the number of people who are drawing benefits was starting to equal or exceed the number of people who were putting money in, then the system got into a financial difficulty. They had a very expensive provision in there, what's called a deferred retirement option program. Members were entitled to a guaranteed return of in excess of 8% for life, and members would leave their money in even after they ended their service with the city, and in essence, this bank was causing a problem. When a new mayor came in and wanted to address the issue, a large number of retirees suddenly pulled their money out, which caused a great cash crunch in the fund, and literally the fund had to stop retirees from taking these lump sum distributions as it was threatening the financial security of the plan.
It's 549-2937 to join the show. So this is coming to a head, is it not? The Texas Supreme Court may even weigh in on this in Dallas?
Yes. What the Dallas plan did, they have a provision in their plan that allows the membership to actually amend the plan, whereas Jacksonville's has to be amended either by the state legislature or the city council. But in Dallas, a supermajority of the members can vote to make changes. They had voted some years ago to lower the drop interest rate to something more reflective of what they were actually making on their investments, and they were sued by a group of retirees, including a former chairman of the Board of Trustees, and the Texas Court of Appeals about 2 weeks ago upheld the board's position. The time for review by the Supreme Court of Texas has not run, but since this is a first of these cases in Texas, I would expect the Supreme Court will weigh in.
How serious is this when it when you look at the long-term financial stability of Dallas, Texas?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it is serious. I mean, from a from a pure survivability standpoint, Dallas is a wealthy city with a large tax base, and it does not have high city taxes. So it has the ability to survive economically. This is not a Detroit or a Jefferson County, Alabama, which are places that were upside down in terms of their economics. But it's going to cost billions to put Texas's financial house, in Dallas, Texas's financial house in order. And it will require all of the parties to come to the table and work it out, which is exactly what folks did in Cincinnati about a year and a half ago, when labor management, the retirees, and the pension folks came together in a year-long mediation and ended up with an agreement where everybody absorbed a little bit of some pain, but the system is now well-funded and the city is able to make its payments.
And if you're just tuning in, 2017 is beginning with no agreement yet between Mayor Lenny Curry and police and fire unions in Jacksonville as they resist Curry's proposal to enroll future hires into 401k-type retirement plans and get Jacksonville out of the public pension business. This type of plan would be virtually unprecedented among major American cities. The unions are resisting, and as we talk about this with nationally renowned public pension expert Bob Klausner, we want your calls and questions. What do you think of Curry's plan? Give us a call, 549-2937. Okay, so Bob, you've explained in detail the situation in Dallas. What sort of parallels can we draw and what sort of lessons can Jacksonville learn from how this all played out in Dallas?
Well, to Jacksonville's credit, it has always made, at least for the last 25 years, it has timely made its pension contribution in full. It, like Dallas, however, had a period in the early 90s where the stock market was flying high and the plan was actually overfunded. And they used that overfunding to increase benefits and also, in lieu of the city, at that time, making a contribution for several years. When the capital markets became unsettled with the dot-com company investment bubble burst in the early 2000s and then the great financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, all of that excess that was used to make these payments suddenly disappeared when the value of the investments disappeared. Mm-hmm. And that left Jacksonville with, in essence, a mortgage or an unfunded liability on these prior issues.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the parallel, however, is that Jacksonville is facing the circumstance that to pay for what prior administrations have done, they're going to have to either raise taxes or dip into reserves or, as most people hate, cut services.
Right, and nobody wants that. So then what are your thoughts about the standoff that we're currently seeing between our police and fire unions and City Hall? Mayor Curry was able to successfully push through a half-cent sales tax proposal to address Jacksonville's glaring pension liability. He's also got to get the unions to come along. That's the final piece of the puzzle.
Well, 401k plans have not been successful for governments. The state of West Virginia went to a 401k style plan for its teachers, and they had a mass exodus and an impossibility of recruiting, and in fact ended up reinstating their defined benefit plan. Nebraska had to do the same thing. Closer to home, the town of Palm Beach, which is one of the wealthiest communities in the country, closed its defined benefit plan, substantially reduced benefits, and installed a 401k-type plan. And while they were expecting to lose some employees, they actually ended up with a personnel crisis. 42% of firefighters and police officers resigned and left the city literally unable to cover the public safety needs of the town, and they have, in fact, reinstated their defined benefit plan.
Wow. So, there could be a considerable backlash to going. Now, is it also accurate to say that transforming public safety union employees to 401k retirement plans, would Jacksonville stand alone among major cities if Jacksonville goes this route? Would we be the biggest American city to do this?
By far. I'm aware of we work with 180 pension plans around the country covering thousands of state and local governments, and Jacksonville would be alone. Jacksonville is one of the 10 largest cities in the country and has a very fine public safety workforce. I think that it would stand alone, and as I understand it, the unions are pushing to be enrolled in the Florida retirement system.
Right. And do you think, given that you're a subject matter expert on pensions, do you think that is a wiser course for the city or not?
I do. Actually, you know, the city council and the mayor are in the Florida retirement system. So are the other constitutional officers in the consolidated city government. For public safety, a cost on a per-person basis annually would be lower than what the per-person cost is in the current police and fire pension fund structure. It would require employees to work a little bit longer than they do now, but it is a very well-funded, secure system. I understand the city's reticence, because when you join FRS, rates and costs are determined by the state legislature and not by the participating employer.
Let's go to your calls now for public pension expert Bob Klausner. As we look at the latest on Jacksonville's pension situation, police and fire unions are digging in their heels and resisting Mayor Curry's call to have them convert to a 401k-style plan as one way to help resolve Jacksonville's massive pension liability. What do you think? It's 549-2937. Ron is on the west side. Hi, Ron. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions. One is, I just heard him, your guest, speak about the FRS, which I agree with. I think the firefighters and the police should be on the FRS, not a 401k. And the other thing I'm curious, maybe your guest could answer, he said that the city made their pension payments in full. Then, just a second later, he said that they had done something else instead of making their payment in full. I was curious what he was making reference to. If you could just further explain that.
Sure.
And also, I thought the city borrowed money from the pension fund that they have yet to reimburse the pension fund for.
Lots of good questions from you, Ron. Thanks so much. He's paying close attention, Bob. Can you answer his questions?
I can. But the first question, in the 1990s, the stock market was running at a comparably higher rate than it is now. Both of the city's defined benefit pension plans were overfunded, meaning they had more assets than liabilities, and pay was lower in those days. And so in order to be able to use those excess earnings, what the city council did is it passed increases in benefits for both plans, but at the same time, the city said, well, we also have excess money in the plan. We'll just live on that interest instead of making our regular annual contribution. And that worked as long as the stock market didn't go down. But when the stock market became more unstable in the early 2000s, the value of the assets declined, and what had been expected to make these payments for prior benefits disappeared with the value of the investment. And that created the unfunded liability, which represents really the majority of the annual contribution that the city is making to the system. The city never takes money out of the pension system to borrow it. The money belongs to the trust and is used exclusively for the participants. But to the extent that excess was used in lieu of a timely employer contribution, and, of course, benefits were increased using that same money, that's where the borrowing took place.
Lots of calls for public pension expert Bob Klausner, 549-2937, as we look at how Jacksonville is starting off the year with still not a final agreement on how to resolve our pension mess. Tom on the north side. Hey, Tom. Good morning.
West side.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes. Well, my question is, what is What of Mr. Keene and his special pension? How is that playing out at this point?
And you're referring to John Keene of the Police and Fire Pension Fund. Thanks for that question, Tom. Bob, of course, Mr. Keene took a lot of criticism for his lavish pension. Is this something that you've seen play out in other cities where a few people really, you know, the perception anyway is that they are gaming the system or getting an especially sweet deal?
No, this is actually a fairly unusual situation that I've seen. I've seen large pensions in other places which have been controversial. I believe that there's currently litigation ongoing involving Mr. Keene's pension, so I usually don't comment on ongoing litigation because you never know how those things are going to turn out. But,
yeah, and he has sued the pension board over his cut in benefits. He filed suit at the end of last year. He served as the fund's chief executive for a quarter of a century. So, yeah, you're right. That to answer the caller's question, Keene's pension is up in the air. We'll continue to follow that. Meanwhile, we want your calls as we connect with Bob Klausner about Jacksonville's pension standoff. It's Karen in Mandarin. Hi, Karen.
Hi. My question is with regard to Bob was talking about people leaving the city and because they're no longer offering what, you know, a pension plan, a definitely determinable benefit every month, and instead are offering a 401k. But my question is, why is that relative? Because since the 1980s, both private employers and municipal employers have been switching over from pension plans. And so I'm curious why that seems to be an issue. Where are those people going to go where they're going to have a pension plan in another city? Because they're all getting rid of them. But my other question is with regard to those glory years when the funds were earning all that money. Every time I hear somebody talk about this, they talk about it like, well, you know, that couldn't be helped. They used all that overfunding, you know, to offset their contributions. And I'm sorry, but that's just a, you know, I don't even know what that is, because anybody who's in charge of a pension plan needs to understand there's going to be ups and downs. My point is, everybody should have been looking for a crash in the market and what that was going to do to the plan, and they should have been looking at that every year. But instead, they just, like, rode the glory wave of, you know, and lived off the what the market was doing. So, anyways,
right.
Those are my questions.
Thanks, Karen. Yeah, and certainly, and as Karen pointed out, there has certainly been a lot of finger-pointing about those decisions that were made in Jacksonville in years past. Bob Klausner.
I can certainly answer those questions. As far as the private sector goes, only about 20% of Fortune 500 companies or S&P 500 companies still maintain a traditional pension plan. Most have gone either to a 401k-style retirement, although a number have gone to what's called a cash balance defined benefit plan. That's a type of plan that funds like a defined contribution plan, and that the employer puts in a set amount of money each year.
And let me just jump in and point out, Bob, that the people that came up with the concept of 401k plans decades ago, they recently, just last week, told the Wall Street Journal that they have regrets, that the 401k model was oversold, that they only intended it to be one leg of a three-legged stool of retirement savings buckets, and that it hasn't worked out the way they'd planned. And so given that new perspective, and given Karen's comment that, well, everyone's going to this type of plan, so why shouldn't the public employees go to it as well, what are your thoughts?
Well, I read the Wall Street Journal article, and in fact, I spoke to the Wall Street Journal about it myself. That's correct. The 401k model was intended as a supplement to a small traditional pension and Social Security. Public safety employees in the city of Jacksonville are exempt from Social Security because they have a regular pension plan. If Jacksonville goes to a 401k, it will likely have to enroll new workers in Social Security, which, as you know, carries a 7.5% matching contribution from the employer. A number of state governments that we've worked with have supplemented their defined benefit programs rather than raising the value of those benefits, have done a 401k overlay to help offset increased costs or to perform the function of a cost of living benefit. I think that's more the model. 93% of public employees in the United States, meaning people employed by state, local government, or the federal government, are still in a traditional pension plan, although many have a 401k supplement. Private sector, you're seeing only about 20% have some sort of traditional pension plan.
And so to be clear, you think that converting Jacksonville's police and fire employees to a 401k plan would be a big mistake, given that in Palm Beach, that ended up had the unintended consequence of affecting public safety.
It did, and I think you would find, unfortunately, the same to be true in Jacksonville. One of two things would happen. Younger workers who are not yet vested, meaning they haven't yet earned the right to a benefit upon retirement, may well go look for greener pastures, meaning another city that has or county that has a traditional pension plan. And what happens is Jacksonville turns into a training ground. The city of Jacksonville, and then most cities in the country, spend about $100,000 per person to train a firefighter or a police officer, plus the early experience that they get on the job. And to lose that experience to another employer and have to keep replacing it is difficult. Anchorage, Alaska, closed their defined benefit plan and joined the state plan, the Alaska equivalent of FRS, about 15 years ago. Alaska itself closed its defined benefit plan about 5 or 6 years ago, and since then, Anchorage has not been able to fill a single recruiting class for either police or fire.
Wow. All right, let's go to David on the south side now. Hey, David, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I have a question about, do the rules for the retirement plans for government, are they the same as for the private industry? Because what it is with private industry is if you cut off a pension plan and add no more, you have to make it whole at the point that you're stopping. And also, since there's not new money coming in, it actually costs you more over the long term because the money's not coming in from the new hires. Also, what happens, we've had very thin information on this 401k, what happens if a person is injured? What happens if a person dies? What happens if the person dies and the wife, they haven't been on the job long enough to build up a 401k? It seems like there's a whole lot of lack of information on the numbers for each scenario, or even what the scenario is and how this would work and the ramifications financially. Because if we're borrowing money to make the plan whole now, shouldn't that cost be run into it? You know, we just don't really have much information, which is typical.
All right. Thank you for that. Bob Klausner.
Yes. To answer the question about whether closing a plan costs more money, it does, because if you don't have new money coming in with lower paid workers, then all you're going to have in short order are people who are retired, and money will be going out. Also, you have less time to pay off any unfunded liability, because in pension management, you're supposed to have the money in the bank on the day a worker retires. On the issue of disability and death benefits for folks who are in a 401k system, there is no insurance product that's currently available in the country to governments to insure police and fire. The mortality rates and the disability rates are too high. It's a bad risk. A person who was in a 401k plan who was injured on day one would receive no benefit. I know one of the motivators in Dallas was the fact that they had the tragic loss of five officers in a single day who were killed in an ambush, and even more were wounded. And the fear of that circumstance is what drove folks out of Palm Beach and other locations where the employer eliminated the traditional death and disability protections.
One more call. Let's go to Albert in Riverside now. Hey, Albert, go ahead.
Hello. Hi, this is Albert, and I was calling to find out, this part of the conversation, had they thought about maybe doing a system that's familiar, that's close to the FERS system for the federal government, and would that be possible to do, where the federal government, you have a three-legged stool where you have your 401k, you have your pension, and then you have Social Security as part of a retirement system. And had they thought about that? That's all.
I don't know if the city has considered that, but a number of states and city governments around the country have done something similar. In other words, they have a base retirement pension benefit, which is a bit smaller than what Jacksonville provides. But then there's also a 401k add-on. And then those employees are also in the Social Security system. And that the idea is that according to economists and actuaries, a worker needs to be able to have about 70% of pre-retirement income in order to live successfully as a fully retired person. A 401k plan, the average American at retirement will have about $150,000 in a 401k plan. And you don't need to be an economist or an actuary to know that that, for a person retiring in their late 60s, isn't going to carry them to life expectancy.
Fascinating to speak with you, and we so appreciate you sharing your expertise with us this morning. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, and we urge all your listeners to continue to support public radio.
Thank you for that, too. Bob Klausner, founding partner at Klausner, Kaufman, Jensen, and Levinston, a Florida firm specializing in public pension law. We'll continue to follow that story here at 89.9. Much more still ahead on this show later. The Jaguars are closing in on a new head coach pick. Culpepper will tell us who might get the nod. But up next, public health and vaccine research, FSCJ's TEDx event, how you can be part of it. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, does Russia hacking the U.S. election count as an act of war? The director of national intelligence declined to answer that during a recent Senate hearing. But what exactly is an act of war? Malicious software can do major damage, and you might consider tampering with our elections and attack on our democracy. At what point would the U.S. respond to malware with the military? Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
We think we're slick. Think nobody knows. Think there's a demarcation between secret us and public us. Not likely. On the next Snap Judgment, sex, lies, and audio tape. Snap Judgment, storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. Tune in every Monday night at 11 and discover new music. As one of the most enduring musical genres, blues can give you a shoulder to cry on, a heart to hang on to, and is here to let you know.
Everything gonna be alright.
Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I said, baby, everything gonna be alright.
medicine.
Welcome back. Well, recent advances in vaccine research have laid groundwork for addressing many of the key public health issues of our century. Not only that, ever new outbreaks of infections challenge researchers and practitioners alike to keep pace with a globally connected health environment. TEDx FSCJ is going to host a salon this week exploring the critical role vaccines play in promoting public health. Now, this is coming up Thursday. Here with a preview, Dr. Pauline Roll, Medical Director with the Duval County Health Department. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Dr. Lourdes Norman McKay, Professor of Biological Sciences with FSCJ. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Vaccination and public health. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. And this is at FSCJ, Dr. McKay. The title of this talk, this salon, is Vaccinating the Future. What prompted health officials to come up with this for Jacksonville?
Well, we welcome a conversation about vaccines. This is a decision that a lot of parents are making with regards to their children, and we want to have an open conversation about any reservations, concerns they may have with vaccinations. And we also want to make people aware of the process by which vaccines come to market, how they're tested for safety, and also new vaccines coming up. Dr. Keith Knutson from the Mayo Clinic will be with us as well, and he is working on a breast cancer vaccination that's currently in phase 2 clinical trials.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So, Dr. Roll, what are some of the most common questions you get when it comes to parents and vaccinations?
Why should I vaccinate my child is one of the common questions that we get. What are the side effects of this vaccination? And why are you guys pushing this so much? And parents are always concerned about what to give their child, when, and why. And so we encourage parents to get educated about the various vaccines and to understand the importance of making sure their children are completely vaccinated.
Now, you said there are new vaccines that you'll be discussing besides the breast cancer vaccine at this event. What else will people learn?
Not so much addressing other vaccines that are in clinical trials, but talking about the vaccination efforts to combat emerging infectious agents like Ebola and Zika. These are hot items, obviously, in the press and a public health concern as well.
Sure. And that goes beyond parents sitting down with their pediatrician. You're looking at this from a global perspective, correct?
Correct. As a scientist myself, I feel it's very important that we sit down with people in our community and help them to understand the science behind the things that we ask them to trust us on. We live in a society where we want to encourage critical thinking and exploration. And so it's not fair for us to then sit back and say, just trust us on this. The public deserves a conversation.
And certainly there's a segment of the public, of parents, who are very skeptical of the current vaccination schedule, in particular how many vaccines parents are now asked to administer to their child. It's a couple of dozen vaccines now before the age of 2. It used to be just a handful. Yeah. So what do you say to parents who, you know, they're not anti-vaccination, but they don't see the need to have so many vaccines?
Right. Well, what we want parents to understand is we live in a global society whereas your child might not have been exposed to some of these diseases many years ago. Now we have folks who travel across the world and are exposed to diseases in other countries, and they may get sick and bring it back. Also, as we get more and more people who choose not to vaccinate, we reduce the number of people who are vaccinated who can potentially prevent the spread of disease in the community. Part of the salon, this TEDx this week, is to encourage dialogue and also to answer questions and also to understand some of the questions that are out there. We understand people have lots of questions, and so we're hoping to have a two-way dialogue here, a multi-way dialogue, where we can all come together and help increase understanding in the community.
Besides parents asking, why does my child need this shot, what are you most commonly asked besides that?
Side effects. What should I expect from this vaccine? Some of the vaccines have common side effects, such as pain at the site, redness at the site. But side effects can go all the way up to allergic reactions. And some folks have a reaction to some of the components of the vaccine. And so it's important for our parents to understand the spectrum of responses that can happen to a vaccine. And for a vast number of the kids, they don't have any reaction at all.
Right. And the majority of kids do just fine.
Right.
There have been children who have had adverse reactions. It's little known that the National Vaccine Court in Maryland compensates parents for vaccine injury. And even though multiple studies have shown there's no link, the most common controversy over vaccines involves autism. Study after study has shown that there is no definable link between the current vaccination schedule and autism in children. That said, the vaccine court has in fact compensated parents whose children have developed autism after vaccination. The most prominent case that comes to my mind is the girl up in Georgia, Hannah Poling. Her family was compensated quite handsomely. So when we see those headlines, that it seems to me that that does create doubt in the minds of some parents about the efficacy and safety of vaccines. Dr. McKay.
Yeah, well, if your child has autism, you want an answer, obviously. Our duty as parents, I have two daughters, our duty as parents is to protect our children. And if something isn't working for them health-wise, we want an answer. And if our children don't have autism, we want to make sure they don't develop it. So it's natural for parents to be curious and want to make sure they're making the right decisions for their children. The thing is that the main concern about vaccines and autism was based on a preservative that was in vaccines. I say was.
It's a Marisol.
Correct.
Mercury.
It's a mercury-based preservative, and it was in vaccines. It's not been in vaccines since 2001, in pediatrics vaccines.
It's still in the flu shot, though, isn't it?
It is still in the flu shot, but the routine vaccination schedule that tends to be the core concern, especially with the MMR vaccine. Thimerosal is no longer in that vaccination. And we've still seen the rates of autism increasing, perhaps because mm-hmm. we identify it now. We can diagnose it more effectively. Yeah.
So when parents talk to you about that type of concern, do you expect that to come up at this salon Thursday night as well?
Absolutely. It is a continued concern for many parents. One of the things about science, in order for research to be validated, it has to be replicable. That study, there have been attempts to replicate it over and over again, and thus far, the studies that have come behind it have not demonstrated the same outcome. What people do not know is that there was a small sample size used with that original research. And so this question will continue to come up, as Dr. McKay stated, because parents want answers. Mm-hmm. And what one of the things about autism is it appears to be multifactorial. Yeah. But until parents get concrete answers, they're always going to question anything that is given to their child or introduced into their child's system.
But as you pointed out, since vaccines have just been such an enormous advance on the whole in terms of public health, this is something that I know in particular with incidents of whooping cough breaking out in some communities where parents haven't gotten that vaccine, the idea of making sure that those types of diseases don't make a whole-scale return to our society, I know that's something doctors are very concerned about. Is that something you worry about here in North Florida?
Yes, we certainly see cases of pertussis here. We treat the cases regularly here. That's why we encourage parents to also maintain their vaccinations, because if you have a child that is less than 2 months, they're not eligible for that vaccine to prevent whooping cough. And so it's important that the parents get vaccinated so they don't contract the disease and in turn give it to their newborn infant.
And people may not realize they can get a low or no-cost vaccine at the health department.
Absolutely. We vaccinate all day long. Up to age 18 years old, children are able to get vaccinated for free.
So this is coming up Thursday, Vaccinating the Future, Thursday night at the FSCJ Deerwood campus. How can people be part? This is a TEDx salon. So how can people be part of this?
Right. So tickets are free. We do ask that you go online to the TEDxFSCJ website, where you can reserve a ticket, and the event will be at 6 o'clock on Thursday.
That's coming up this Thursday, the TEDx Salon on the FSCJ Deerwood campus, Vaccinating the Future. Dr. Pauline Roll, Medical Director with the Duval County Health Department, and Dr. Lourdes Norman-McKay, she's Professor of Biological Sciences at FSCJ. Doctors, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
In a moment, Cole Pepper as the Jaguars zero in on their new coach. That's next.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Bridges. His performance in the Western Hell or High Water has been nominated for a Golden Globe. We'll talk about Bridges' life and films, his Oscar-winning performance in the 2009 film Crazy Heart, and his cult favorite character, the Dude, from The Big Lebowski. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next episode of Hometown, veteran skydiver Art Schaefer takes us on a thrilling adventure at Skydive Palatka. Kathy Godwin serves up clean foods for the health conscious and people with digestive diseases at Kathy's Table. Artist Ursula Joseph sculpts lifelike dolls using polymer clay. And photography student Lucas Stanley explores ancient art through modern photography. Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the Jaguars are closing in on a decision on their new head coach.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
And then there were three. Cole Pepper is here with a look at the final list. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, it does appear there are three finalists now, and we've heard different reports over the last couple of days on all three of these. Mm-hmm. One is New England offensive coordinator and former Broncos head coach Josh McDaniels. Of course, he has had great success as an offensive coordinator with Tom Brady as his quarterback. Some would say he's had great success and because he's had Tom Brady as his
riding the coattails of Tom Brady right. as his quarterback.
And quite honestly, the New England Patriots assistants who have left to go elsewhere have not had great success traditionally. It's been, you know, when they've been in New England under Bill Belichick and with Tom Brady, they've had great success, but elsewhere the success hasn't necessarily followed. Also, former Falcons head coach and one-time Jaguars defensive coordinator Mike Smith appears to be one of the finalists. Analyst Mark Dominic, the former Tampa Bay Buccaneers general manager, said on a national satellite radio show that the Jaguars had made their decision and it was a guy with a defensive background. That would indicate that it would be Smith who could come to town, return to Jacksonville, this time as the head coach. And then there's Doug Marrone, who finished the season as the Jaguars' interim head coach after Gus Bradley was let go. Now, let's size up the competition a little bit here.
Right.
Talk about if one of these guys is the guy or which one of these might be a difference maker. Smith is the only defensive background guy. And typically, as we talked about, when you have a defensive-minded players coach, you would go with an authoritarian offensive-minded coach. You know, it's that 180-degree flip.
Right.
Doesn't always happen that way, but typically it would. So that would be a little bit of a step out in terms of Mike Smith. But do remember that when he was the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons, Matt Ryan came into the league and had great success as a quarterback. So he does have experience as a head coach working over a quarterback who's developing as a young quarterback. And that's a major part of this storyline for the future for Blake Bortles.
Of the three, who do you like, Cole Pepper?
I like Mike Smith.
Mike Smith.
I do. I like him personally. I have a great deal of respect for him. When he was here as the defensive coordinator, the Jaguars had some of their best years as a defense. When he left and Jack Del Rio remained on as the head coach, defense tailed off a little bit. So that tells you something about the impact that a coordinator can have. But the best coordinators don't necessarily make great head coaches, but Smith did have success in Atlanta. Let's also remember that Dave Caldwell, the Jaguars general manager, was a personnel man in Atlanta when Smith was there. So he has this connection. And during the press conference talking about what they were going to do for the future, I asked Dave Caldwell how much he was going to rely on his own personal network to make this decision and how much he's going to reach out to people to get second opinions. And he said, ultimately, it's going to be about how the guy sitting across from him, how he reads that in terms of the interview. But most of the time in these hires, particularly with a guy who has had some experience, they tend to settle in on guys who they have familiarity with. And certainly Marrone and Mike Smith are that for Dave Caldwell.
Well, and they've got nowhere to go but up, but certainly whoever they pick, a lot of pressure on that person to deliver some results pretty quickly.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be Super Bowl in 2 years, but I think you have to be to the point where, you know, by 2018, you're a team that's competing for, if not making the playoffs. I think the pressure, because of the long list of losing seasons the Jaguars have behind them now, they've got to turn around pretty quickly. And remember, when Dave Caldwell came in, initially, they basically blew up the roster. So they've built this thing for the last 4 years. It's not where they wanted it to be. We'll see how much of that was coaching and how much that can turn around. I think we could have an answer on this week, though.
This week. Okay. We'll keep listening for that. Meanwhile, some more news and notes. Let's talk for a minute about the Jacksonville Armada.
Yeah, they will have a new owner for the 2017 season. For the time being, the North American Soccer League will own the team while new ownership is sought. Mark Frisch launched the team, but was seeking new ownership, so the league has taken that over. This has been a tumultuous offseason for the North American Soccer League. There was some concern that the league might go away. Instead, it's staying and remaining as the second tier of American soccer, but now being joined on the second division by the USL. So there are now two second division U.S. soccer teams, soccer leagues, and we'll see how that plays going forward. There could be some other changes coming for the Armada, including potentially where they play their home matches.
And is the appetite there here in Jacksonville for professional soccer?
Well, you know, I'll point to the fact that the first ever regular season game had 16,000 people there, and there are so many kids playing youth soccer. And for the first year and a half, really, the Armada drew very well. It fell off a bit in the second half. A little bit. When football season comes around, soccer is going to take a backseat. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And the second half of this past season, there wasn't the same kind of following as the team continued to lose. I think they need to win games. That's mm-hmm. part of it. And I think they need to reconnect with the soccer community that does exist in Jacksonville and have that outreach to get more people out there, because I think there is that market. It's just, you know, it's not a roll the ball out there and 10,000 people are going to show up. It takes work.
Last but not least, this is kind of fun to talk about. The first ever installment of the River City Rumble over the weekend, UNF versus JU.
Yeah, first of the year, first of two. UNF won 80-64 on the basketball court. The rematch is February 23rd. And Melissa, I don't want to get out of here before we do spend a moment on the national championship game tonight with Alabama against Clemson in college football, because a lot of folks will be paying attention to that. There are a lot of alums of both schools living here in Jacksonville, and it's a rematch of last year's national championship game won by Alabama, and Bama has been the best team all year long from the very beginning of the year all the way through. Now, the one potential chink in the armor for Alabama, they have a freshman quarterback, Jalen Hurts. Clemson has a two-time Heisman Trophy finalist quarterback in Deshaun Watson. If Clemson is going to win, and that's a big if, but if Clemson is going to win, it's going to have to be Watson making big plays against maybe the best defense that Alabama has had under Nick Saban, and that's saying something.
Where's the best place to watch that one?
Well, I mean,
where are all the fans going to be?
You know, that's a great question. I think it's going to be interesting to see. There are some Clemson bars and Alabama bars and that sort of thing. But I think wherever you are used to watching your game, you should probably stop by and if you want to be in the atmosphere with other fans watching it, the sports bar is always a great way to do it. Or if you're like me and kind of like to concentrate on the game, the best place for me to watch it will be at Historic Pepper Manor.
The couch of Cole.
Yes.
He's Cole Pepper. Follow him on Twitter. And thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. That's a wrap for us. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs our board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or the WJCT app. Next on 1A, does Russia hacking the U.S. election count as an act of war? And what exactly is an act of war? That's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.